Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we begin another hour of the show. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. Well, now we're into a new year, and I expect there are probably a lot of people who made a resolution here, as people often do at the beginning of the year, have made a resolution to try to be more organized. And they think, certainly, I'm sure, about trying to be more organized in the spaces where they work and the spaces where they live. And in this part of the show, we'll be having some advice for you on a kind of internal organization, that is, what people can do to organize their minds. And we have two guests with us, Margaret Moore and Dr. Paul Hammerness. Margaret Moore is an executive wellness coach. She's co-director of the Institute of Coaching at McLean Hospital. That's a teaching affiliate of the Harvard Medical School. She's also the founder and CEO of Well Coaches Corporation. That's a leading coach training school. Dr. Hammerness is a clinical researcher on ADHD. He is assistant professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, assistant psychiatrist at Mass General Hospital. And the two of them are the co-authors of a book that's titled Organize Your Mind, Organize Your Life, the subtitle Train Your Brain to Get More Done in Less Time. It's published in paperback by Harlequin, so it's not terribly expensive. And I think it has some good basic advice, some tips to offer. And as we talk, questions from people who are listening are welcome. The number 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana. Here where we are. We have a toll-free line also, 800-222-9455. So if it's long distance, use that. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, people are certainly welcome to engage us with questions, comments, their own stories about their issues with being organized between the years, and any and all of that is certainly welcome. And our guests are joining us from a studio at Harvard, so we're happy to have this high-quality connection with them. Ms. Moore, hello.
Hello, David. Wonderful to be here.
Well, glad that you could be with us. And Dr. Hammerness, hello.
Hi, thanks so much for having us.
Good. You start out, I think, by noting the kind of frenzied pace of life that we have now, and that people feel that there are so many things to keep track of, and as maybe has been the case throughout human history, our labor-saving devices sometimes, rather than making our lives easier, just make them that much more complicated, and, you know, particularly that we have all of these pocket-sized things that keep us in touch with each other and what we're supposed to be doing and all of that. We're doing all of this at one time. And it seems like, what people like often do is they say, well, the problem here is really, it's not in us. It's out there in the world somewhere. Too much stuff, too much distractions, too much going on. And you seem to be making the argument, well, you know, maybe the problem's not so much out there in the world. And then it really is inside us. And how we approach dealing with all that stuff that's out there in the world. And we'll let the market go first.
Well, that's a great point. I think we have never seen more frenzy, stress, frustration, overwhelm than today. I can't remember an era in my lifetime where more people said they were distracted. And so the point about organizing your mind is that, in fact, the brain was designed with various what you might call software programs to be able to deal with distractions, to be able to calm frenzy, to be able to focus and be creative and productive. And so what we hope to do with the book is really help people appreciate that they just need to tap into what's there, maybe unlearn some things, but really plug into what's already there and use it better.
Mm. I was really interested to note that, Dr. Hammerness, that you had done research on attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, the ADHD. The thing I thought about is the fact that so many people seem to think that, particularly because of computers and smartphones and 24-hour access to friends and news and messages and phone calls and texts and tweets and what have you, that we're somehow all giving ourselves ADHD. You know, that it's actually promoting that. And I don't know what you think about an argument like that.
Well, you're right. people will talk about it. You know, I think the good aspect to that is that there's more understanding about ADHD. People are more aware that ADHD is a disorder that starts in childhood but can continue into adulthood for a lot of folks. And so, I'm happy that it's sort of part of the general language out there. But the rates of ADHD are pretty stable. It's only probably 4 to 5% of the adult population. That's still a pretty big number, but the majority of people who feel overwhelmed and feel distracted don't have the clinical disorder. But the book really is for everybody. I think that people with ADHD certainly can benefit from these principles, but it's really aimed to help people. In all walks of life with facing all issues, not just about ADHD.
Yeah. To talk a little bit more about multitasking, just because it seems that not only are we forced to do it, we're expected to do it. I think that there are some people who seem to take a perverse kind of pride in how many things they say that they can do at one time. And it's something that probably the younger you are, the more you can boast that you can do it. I think, though, that there are some questions about how effective people really can be when they're trying to split their attention between so many different things.
Yes, David, you're right. I mean, it turns out that multitasking is not what the brain was designed to do. The brain was designed to focus all of its resources on one thing at a time. So when you split, as you say, or scatter your attention across many things, all you're doing is only using a little piece of your brain's resources for each thing. So you can't possibly be at your best. You're not going to get to the big picture. You're not going to get to that calm, wise perspective on anything in that place. The alternative is to what scientists call shift sets. And that's about shifting all of your focus, you know, kind of like a basketball player jumps and lands in a new place. So you literally move your whole beam, the whole spotlight of your attention to something else. If you do that rapidly, you know, if you're very cognitively flexible or agile, you may be able to, for a period, be able to switch your focus and move all of your attention among things. But for most people, that is pretty depleting. I mean, you can't keep that up for long. And so I think that a big message of the book is to move to unitasking and set even a few moments aside for complete focus on each task.
Yeah, and certainly there are plenty of examples. We have plenty of examples today about how this fragmenting of our attention can not only be counterproductive because it's hard to get things done, but it can also be extremely dangerous. And I guess the one thing that people are going to point to right away is the problem that we seem to have in this country with distracted driving and people doing things other than paying attention to where they're going, keeping their eyes on the road, and that can have very serious consequences.
Sure, absolutely. That's an area that has come up, and there may be new regulations, new guidelines, across the nation about that, to say we need to get better control of these devices that can be tremendously helpful for us, but that may be running amok a bit here, and that drivers may need to say, no use of phones unless it's a real emergency in the car. To get, as sort of an extreme example of what we need to do to set limits around these distractions and to be in more control over them than they are in control of us.
Yeah. Well, for people who I'm sure that most everyone at least sometime feels overwhelmed by the daily demands of life, because they say, look, there's just all these things I have to think about and keep track of, people I have to do things for, me, my partner, my children, my boss, and that they say it's just the problem is that there's too much stuff. I think that you're trying to make a different kind of argument and said, well, but maybe the issue here is not so much how many things you have to deal with, but how you approach the whole task of organizing everything you have to deal with. And how do you persuade people that, in fact, that really is an organizational issue and not so much that truly you have more stuff that you can actually deal with?
Yeah, that's right, David. I think that what happens is that people get into a downward spiral thinking about the 32 things they're not doing, rather than doing the one thing that's in front of them well. And that frenzy from feeling overwhelmed, we know negative emotions impair the thinking brain's ability to function. And so it's actually counterproductive to fret about the other 32 things. Mm-hmm. There'll always be 32 things, or maybe 33. You know, that's just a fact of life. And so what I think we can propose to people is to just put them aside for the periods you're focusing. And what'll happen at the end of a day is that you will get more done because you haven't fretted about the other 32 things. And the other things, well, they'll still be there. You'll feel better about having been productive. And that's energizing rather than depleting, which then sets you up to tackle a few more the next day. So it's really about switching your relationship with this overwhelm so that it doesn't overwhelm your ability to focus.
Well, and I think that you make the point that maybe a big issue here is the fact that for a lot of people, stress-induced anxiety is also really counterproductive, and that if you're suggesting people that one of the things they can do is to try to relax, try to be more calm, and not do what you can not to make yourself crazed, to allow yourself to be crazed, will really help a lot. I mean, and that'll go a long way right at the beginning to help you feel a little bit more settled and more able to deal with whatever it is that you have to deal with.
That's right. That's really the first step. And that's how the book is organized. It talks about managing emotions. And in the first rule of order, we describe these different brain errors that we call rules of order. And we talk about the first rule of order being managing emotions. We call it tame the frenzy. And so, and the structure of the book is to talk about these science principles, these brain areas that need to be functioning well or relating well to each other, and then follow that with practical tips to work on each of these areas. But the first step, really, to get organized, it's not about diving into a new device. It's not about a new desktop calendar. It's about taking a good, hard, honest look at your emotions when you're sitting down to do a task. Because if the emotional areas of your brain are red hot and firing, you don't have a chance to focus, let alone to be organized, which is sort of steps down the road. So that really is the first step. Yeah.
And that's I'm sure that so many people would say, yes, I hear that, Doc, but you know, that's really very difficult. When you're feeling very emotionally overwrought, it's like it short circuits the logical part of your brain, and that it makes it, and when you're feeling all emotionally heated, the idea of cooling down a little bit, because I've certainly had this experience, and I'm sure a lot of people have, is that you're dealing with some kind of a challenge, and you're having some difficulty, and you're getting frustrated, and you're not quite sure what to do, and you sort of panic and find out that maybe later, if you just relax about it, a solution will come, or you'll say, oh, wait a minute, I think I can do this. But getting yourself all tied up in knots where you're thinking, oh my God, I can't deal with this. What's going on? You know, to get from from the hot state to the cool state seems like that's really difficult. How do you do that?
Well, that really is a new skill for many people, and I think everyone really has to experiment with a combination of things. Like in my case, I rely on a combination of things that all get the thermostat down to a cool enough place where I can focus. And because our brains are all different, then, you know, for us to prescribe, you know, do A, B, C, and D is not likely to work. And so what we recommend in the book is to experiment with a few things. And what's kind of cool is that the things that actually produce a healthy body, like exercise, you know, eating the right nutrition so your brain is well fed, you know, so you don't crash after a donut or a coffee, and sleeping well, and meditating, even a few deep breaths. And so I'd really encourage everybody to make this one of your resolutions, which is to come up with a synergistic group of things that all together bring you to a place of calm when you start your days so that you really enjoy the focus periods that you have.
I would just dive into clinically, mm-hmm. you know, what I do in the office you know, what a psychiatrist is really an objective person in the room saying, tell me about this. Tell me about this. How do you feel when you sit down to try to do something? What are your thoughts? What does your body feel like? And it's an objective person's taking a step back and saying, look, you know, I'm seeing some themes here. I'm seeing some patterns here. And I think it's easy for people to miss those things and to run with something and say, well, of course I'm worried or of course I'm angry. Anybody would feel that way. Well, challenge those thoughts because that's not necessarily the case. You know, would every single person you know faced with this stress have a worried thought? I'm sure you could imagine someone actually having more of an angry thought. How dare that person ask me to do something versus, you know, oh, no, I can't do it. So really challenge the thoughts that you have. Look at them carefully. Look for patterns. Look for themes. And that really is part of the process, too, absolutely, along with these, you know, key things like exercise and sleep and the practical tips we talk about. But just the process of thinking about these patterns and themes provides the cognitive, the thinking areas of the brain, even in that moment, just to kick in and to be more in charge. It gives a little distance from the emotions, gives you a sense of saying to the emotions, really, you know, is that really accurate? Is that really appropriate in the moment? Testing mm-hmm. them, thinking about them.
Mm-hmm. Let me just introduce again our guest for somebody who might have just tuned in. Last person you heard is Paul Hamernes. He's a clinical researcher on ADHD. He's a physician, a psychiatrist. He's assistant professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. And he is the co-author, along with Margaret Moore. She's an executive wellness coach, co-director of the Institute of Coaching at McLean Hospital, which is a teaching affiliate of the Harvard Med School. They're the co-authors of the book, Organize Your Mind, Organize Your Life, Train Your Brain to Get More Done in Less Time. It is a paperback. It is published by Harlequin. And we thought, as this is a time of year when some people are making resolutions about being more organized in their life, and they're, I'm sure they're thinking about the places they live and work, organizing spaces, we thought, well, maybe it wouldn't be such a bad thing to talk about what you can do to organize your head. That is what's inside. Organize your brain, your mind. And questions, comments, welcome. We have an opportunity for you to call. You can send us an email. If you want to call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. If you would like to email, the address is will-talk, at illinois.edu. And here is a caller, in fact. We'll talk with them. Somebody on line number one, right here. Hello.
Hi. Hi. Really have something else to do, but I'll do this instead. I'm suspicious of all these self-help books, and I'm just curious. You've been alluding back to the structure of the brain. I'm just curious about the methodology of how are you generating, or maybe there's some example you can give to me that's concrete that shows that the brain science you're referring to actually how it illuminates your theses and your advice, and because I just get suspicious of the self-help books and claims to scientific backing when, so basically, how can you respond to a skeptic about this as far as, and sort of giving a concrete example of what you mean when you refer back to the structure of the brain, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Dr. Hamernes, how about you take that one?
Sure. I appreciate the call. That's an excellent question. The methods, So my part of the book, again, the structure of the book is to talk about brain areas that have to do with organization. And they involve areas of the brain that manage emotions, areas of the brain that help with attention, areas of the brain that are responsible for managing impulses. And then we talk about the connections of those areas of the brain because in the latter part of the book, because it's artificial to think that it's, you know, just one brain area doing one thing. There's a lot of interconnectedness. And so that's my science part. And the description of the brain areas comes from my work in clinical research. It comes from my work in clinical research on ADHD in children and adults. And in our office, we do clinical research studies that involve looking at medicines, looking at brain imaging, looking at cognitive testing, looking at genetics. So looking very broadly at ADHD, trying to understand it from lots of different viewpoints. And ideally pulling it all together to say that for a given individual, when we see a medicine working, we see areas of the brain changing, looking more like a typical area of the brain in terms of how it's functioning versus someone else. We see performance on a cognitive task that shows improved attention. So ideally, we pull all this together. And so that's the methodology comes from all that clinical research experience over the last 10 years or so. And also from my clinical experience working with children, adolescents, and adults, really seeing how disorganization tracks and changes over time. So that's the clinical research and the clinical background that, that brings and informs these brain principles. And in the book, we cite some specific researchers and some interesting studies that highlight these different brain areas. But absolutely, I'm with you on the skepticism about self-help. I want it to be grounded in something. And the hope with this book is that it's different, that it is grounded, that it is something that, although maybe not necessarily a quick, easy read, that it will resonate with people and it'll really inform people so that they can stick with these principles as because they understand them and really stick with them over time versus more of a sort of a gimmicky approach.
Well, just to you know, I made the kind of a slightly flip observation that a lot of people feel overwhelmed by the demands of their life and feel that they may be coming down with ADHD, and you said, well, you can relax about that. The number of people, there are people who have clinical ADHD, and then, but probably most people don't. So having said all that, though, what say, tell me something that, that perhaps you might have learned by actually studying and working with people who truly have attention deficit disorder that applies to everybody else who just feels overwhelmed by that person who just feels overwhelmed by life.
Sure. Well, ADHD is a very is a chronic condition for a lot of people. You know, like asthma could be starts in childhood, goes through adolescence into adulthood, and just like other disorders, people do things to try to limit how the disorder affects them. So just like someone with asthma would work very hard at not smoking or maybe not having other allergens like cats in the home or being careful about when they exercise in the winter, people with ADHD do a lot of things to try to compensate and try to manage the difficulties with their forgetfulness, with their losing items, with their distractibility. And so people come in oftentimes feeling like they've got a point where they can't manage anymore, but full of stories about what works for them, the sort of the systems that they say that work for them. And so I've learned a great deal from how people try to manage these symptoms over time. And that really informs the book too.
Okay. Ms. Moore, anything you want to add on to that?
I just want to, again, thank the caller for making his point because this book was put together by Harvard Health, which is the publications arm of Harvard Medical School. And the intention was to start with the science and to appreciate. I mean, one of the key things that I find my coaching clients really appreciate is that this, and this may be something most people already know, but that the limbic system, the older part of the brain, which processes our emotions, in particular our negative emotions, you know, works better to take over the thinking part of the brain, the executive function, the prefrontal cortex in some people than in others. And so CEO types, for instance, typically have very good executive function, which means they are very good at managing their emotions, their emotional state, and their distractions. And others are not. And so so people, I think, find it very interesting to think about where are they on that spectrum, which would not be ADHD, but would be normal brain. But I just happen to have more access to my emotional life, and I have less control of it by my prefrontal cortex, whereas the more organized person might have better prefrontal cortex control over the emotional brain. And I find people, you know, when you have good science and you can explain it, it creates a metaphor, it creates a picture for what might be happening, and it gives people a handle on something that otherwise is quite abstract. And so people make jokes about kind of managing their wild emotional brain. you know, which is also their friend because it provides a lot of creativity. So I think seeing the brain as having these different functions can really help people understand why is my brain so quirky? You know, why do I do this? Why does this other person not do that?
Well, let's go on. I hope that's at least a partial answer for the caller. And we'll go next to talk with somebody in Paxton. This is on line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, David, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Great show. I joined in the conversation a little late, so I don't know if this was covered. An observation and then maybe a quick question for your guest. You mentioned about the electronic devices and all of that, and what I've noticed is it's making us to become reactionary. In other words, we may physically be in one location, one state, but because of the cell phones and the Blackberries and the Blueberries and all the rest of it, we're somewhere else. I observed this during the holidays where we had a number of guests over in 20s and 30s, and they're electronically connected. They're in the room with you, but they're doing something else. And I don't see that ever changing. But my question is, back when I was an undergraduate about 10,000 years ago, we learned a concept called locus of control. And they were taught basically that's the single most important thing you can teach your child growing up is they actually do have control of their lives. And, you know, outcomes do matter. And I was just wondering if your guests could speak on that. And also in their studies, did they find any difference between the sexes, male and female, and how they react to things? And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Well, you can take that on anywhere you like.
Well, the caller brings up, you know, I'm scribbling down some notes as he's talking. He brought up several really wonderful points. I'll try to cover a couple of them. One was the idea about people being very reactionary to these devices, and that is true. We have lost control over them, and aren't managing our impulses to just react to them. And I heard on another talk show recently someone talking about that they were apologizing to a friend for not responding to their text within like 3 minutes. And the person telling them it was really okay. We really need to embrace the brain's ability to manage and to stop and to what we call apply the brakes, another rule of order, to be able to manage the urge to leap to something else and to be able to have good control over that impulse, the impulse to respond to the email, to respond to the text message, et cetera. The other point that the caller brought up, which is wonderful, is the idea about locus of control. I work with all ages. I spend a good amount of my time clinically working with children and adolescents, and just saw a child the other day where this issue came up very much, and the family was working very hard on helping the child be organized. And for years had been working on that. The child was now, you know, a teenager and was really rebelling and pushing back against it and feeling pretty demoralized. And I think because they had missed the locus of control point, they were trying to really instill their organizational principles to the child, and they weren't things that the child was embracing. And so we really want to look and within the book have people find things that resonate with them, that work for them, that is coming from them. So there is a sense of locus of control, which is so key, absolutely, in working with children and adolescents, but also with adults too. So wonderful points.
Yeah, maybe I would ask Margaret Moore if you have anything to say about the question on gender. I'm expecting that probably, at the very least, there would be a lot of women who would be arguing that they would be much better at multitasking than men because they have to. But whether there are true differences between men and women when it comes to being able to manage all of these stressors, I don't know.
Yes, and I think having consulted the scientists, there is no data on this, so we can only guess. And I guess I was thinking about this the other day, because as a woman, I can kind of see the female perspective of this, but I also have very good focus, and so my guess is that the radar in women's brains in terms of scanning the environment is probably turned up a notch a little bit around, you know, listening for children in trouble. You know, so I wouldn't be surprised if women's brains are picking up more of that. And as a result, women often say, I'm not good at compartmentalizing, which is the opposite of multitasking. Whereas men can sit down. I see this in business. I remember when I was in my 20s, I'd watch men, there'd be some sort of crisis, and they could focus. And I found it a struggle to not let the frenzy get there. And I've only, at you know, my age at this point, gotten very good at compartmentalizing, which I think is a skill. So my guess is that women have more trouble. Their brains are probably designed to be more in touch with the emotional stimuli around them. And as a result, and so then you make the case, well, and I've heard women say, well, I'm a way better multitasker than my husband. And, you know, I'd say in response, you know, do be careful about that, because it may well be that if you're driving and talking to your child and answering the phone, you're probably not doing any of those things well. So I think women have to be careful. We probably have to work harder at doing the set shifting well, which is really complete compartmentalization when we shift our focus.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus with two guests, Dr. Paul Hammernis and Margaret Moore, and they're the co-authors of a book, Organize Your Mind, Organize Your Life, Train Your Brain to Get More Done in Less Time. So I'm not trying to do too many things. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Mitt Romney's careers in politics and venture capital, and his ancestors' prominent place in the history of the Mormon Church. We talk with Michael Cranish and Scott Hellman of the Boston Globe about their new book, The Real Romney. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here Monday through Friday from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics, a good mix of things we hope that can be helpful, interesting. Let me mention a couple of shows that do have to do with trying to be more organized. We'll talk tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock with Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at the U of I. Once a month, we always do this show. It's on a Friday, and the idea is that you can call in and ask questions about money management. So that's tomorrow at 10. A very specific kind of money management will be the subject for Monday at 10. This is a show dedicated to talking about estate planning, and our guest will be John Elder. He is an attorney and estate planner with a local law firm here in our area. Let me mention one more, and that's Monday in the 11 o'clock hour. This is our regular program on women's health, and our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist with a practice in our area. Every other month she is on the program. It's always Monday, and she comes here prepared to talk about what's new in her field, but also to answer questions. You can check the schedule by going to our website, will.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, we have two guests. Margaret Moore is an executive wellness coach. She's co-director of the Institute of Coaching at McLean Hospital. That's a teaching affiliate of the Harvard Med School. Also joining us is Dr. Paul Hammernis. He is a psychiatrist. He is an assistant professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Med School, does clinical research on attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The two of them together are the authors of a book that we have talked about here, are talking about. The title of the book is Organize Your Mind, Organize Your Life. And it's published by Harlequin, is in paper. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk at illinois.edu. I want to come back to the question of focusing, because I think that, you know, a lot of people will say, yeah, I have trouble with that. It's difficult. Maybe I have some particular task I really need to do. But there's a lot of things on my mind, in addition, you know, the art and the environment can toss all sorts of distractions in our way. Maybe, I'll turn first to Dr. Hammonders and then Margaret Moore, you might want to respond to. What kind of suggestions do you have for that very thing? You know, how is it you can really focus on the thing that you need to get done?
Well, that is the sort of, you know, fun. You think about these in lots of ways. Think about sort of building blocks skills to make this sort of pyramid of being organized. And, you know, the first one is, like we talked about, managing emotions, getting your emotional house in order, so to speak, so that you can then step up and focus on a task for, you know, we're talking about a chunk of a half an hour, 45 minutes. People might say reflexively, oh, sure, I do that. But think about that for a moment. That really is, you know, a decent little chunk of time. I think people are much more used to doing things 5-10 minutes now. And moving on to something else, and this becomes this multitasking. So in a half an hour, you're juggling work and some personal phone calls and some planning for the weekend, et cetera, et cetera. So we're talking about sustaining focus for chunks of time that's more like a half an hour, 45 minutes, really as a starting point. And my piece of that topic, of that rule, describes how the brain, areas of the brain are responsible for helping you sustain your focus, and the brain's remarkable ability to pull in information, but also to be able to pick up the signal, the important information in the context of all sort of the noise going on around us. And the brain is remarkable in its ability to do that, and we want to revel in its ability to help us sustain focus and filter out all the extraneous distractions in life. So that's my piece, and then I'll let Margaret to jump in.
Yes, so to produce, you know, your best focus, there are a number of things to bear in mind. The first is you really have to kind of get your motivation to kick in and to take a moment just to declare, this is my intention, this is what I want to do. If you want to go a little deeper, you know, and sort of move to the heart, move to the emotional, the positive emotional drive, you know, how is this going to make the world a better place? You know, how is this going to make a difference in my work and my family? So you want to bring the intention and the purpose, because that's the drive. And when you have a good source of drive, you know, people usually have things in their lives that they love to do. They just, you know, they just pour their hearts into them and they get them done. And you want to sort of tap into that. Either, you know, the sort of more cognitive goal, you know, I need to do this so that I don't get fired, or the heartfelt goal, you know, this is who I am, this is what I want to, how I want to make a difference today. So you know, if you just take a moment and tell your brain, this is what I want to do and this is why I want to do it, and I'm going to put the time aside, and then that sort of builds the motivation. Then how do you build your confidence to be able to sustain the focus? Because it's those two things, motivation and confidence, that allow us to do difficult things. And the confidence piece comes from, again, thinking ahead. You know, okay, so I may get some texts, I might get some emails, so I'm actually going to turn off the wireless on my computer, on my phone. If you have a door to close, I'm going to close the door. Some people actually like to have a little music on in the background. You know, that's not my preference. But whatever the conditions, again, back to coming up with your own set of conditions that allow you to create this focus period and then dive in. And then when the distractions come up, because they will, because the brain is scanning for them, you know, take a moment and, again, stop and sort of, hello, distraction. It looks like, you know, there's something that could be done here, but maybe, you know, maybe I'll, the best decision to make is to stay on course. Or, you know, it's an emergency. My son just fell out of a tree and I've really got to stop and take care of that. So become more mindful, you know, again, using your attention, talking about locus of control, is actually like driving it, like you're driving a car. And when you, that means you're going to drive it, you're going to take it somewhere, and you're going to brake when you need to and keep going if you need to. So it's that intentional kind of mindfulness about your focus that I think really makes a difference.
Okay. Let's talk with somebody else. To Charleston. This is our next caller. Line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Yes.
I have two questions. And the first, I think, is for the coaching professor from McLean.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be more helpful, because sometimes this is what we learn in textbooks, to not consider the differences between the sexes as qualitative and treat them as different types altogether, but as quantitative, and talk about more of like the mixture of hormones that may exist in either. And then the second question, I think, is for the other guest at the clinical. And it's, there was a documentary called Generation RX, and they seem to suggest, they had evidence, I think, that a lot of the panel for the DSM, those people that create the criteria for these diagnoses, a majority of those were actually being paid by the large pharmaceutical companies. And I was just curious what you thought about that potential conflict of interest and, you know, how you take the DSM if you're aware of those kind of conflicts. Okay, thank you very much, and I'll listen off air.
All right, thank you. Well, there's an entire show in that second question. You can take that on however you like.
Shall I start with the first?
We can do that. Go ahead.
So we were talking, I think your caller was asking about the difference between qualitative and quantitative aspects that might impact function of our focus and organizational software. And I guess the way I would look at that is that I think what he meant is that the qualitative is sort of our experience of it. And that the quantitative is sort of maybe the biological drivers, you know, that maybe they're the wiring, the hormones, the whole physiological aspect of what impacts our brain could also be important. I hope I've got that right. And that's so true. What is going on in our bodies, and of course male and female bodies are different in terms of the whole hormonal side in particular, that could well make big differences. And then even among women, you may have a variety of differences. You know, people talk about perimenopause and menopause having difficulty focusing, having difficulty accessing working memory. So yes, those are, you know, I always say you've got to, whenever something's not working quite right, you know, you've sort of got a quirky mind, there's always two questions. Is it psychology? Is it my emotional state and my thoughts? Or is it biology? Is it something else that's going on? And I think it's an ongoing question for all of us.
Dr. Amarnes, you got to take this other question here about which brings in all sorts of things, whether we rely too much on medications, whether there are physicians who have important conflicts of interest because they have relationships with pharmaceutical companies. It could and maybe should be an entire show. But, you know, what do you think about that?
Right. That's an excellent question. And you're right. There's lots of ways to talk about that and to respond to that. I guess what I would say, and I talk about this certainly plenty in my clinical practice, I'm happy to, I think it's good for us as a society to ask ourselves, what's the role of medicines in our lives? Is it part of a balanced way of living? Is it part of embracing science and technology? That is the ideal, I think, versus it's something that we go to as an easy out, an easy escape, a crutch. You know, instead of working on diet and exercise, you know, instead of doing the right things for sleep, you know, we look to a pill. So, yes, as a society, I think that we can be medicine-focused, sort of easy answer-focused, and in part because we're so busy and so hard to find sort of the important more chronic preventative strategies that we need to do, like exercising well, sleeping well, et cetera. And so I don't think psychiatry is any different in that respect than any other sort of field of medicine. I think you should ask, you know, the same question about, you know, the use of inhalers or the use of medicines for sleep, et cetera. So that's sort of one point. You know, along those lines, it's good to think about the spectrum of abilities out there. And this book is really for a spectrum of people. It's not just about ADHD. It's not just for people with ADHD. It's nice to step back from ADHD and just say, whether you believe that there's influences on developing the criteria for ADHD, if you have concerns about that, let's just step back and say, do you believe that there's a range of abilities out there? Do you believe that there are a percentile of people who struggle with basic attention and disorganization more than the rest of folks? Just like you would say that there's a range of people who are shorter than the rest of folks, or there is a range of people who are slower when they're running a race, you know, or a driving abilities, anything. There's a range of people out there. And really what psychiatry comes down to, when this DSM diagnostic comes down to, is just defining, you know, a subset of people who suffer more of the conditions that that afflict a lot of people.
Okay. Well, let's. We're getting kind of short on time. Maybe you have about 6-7 minutes, so I want to make sure we get at least one more caller, and we have somebody waiting here in Champaign. We'll go to them. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I had a question about categorizing different types of tasks for multitasking, and what I mean by that, why is it a certain task seem to go easier together for multitasking than others? Like, for example, you know, early on, way back when I first started driving a car as a teenager, I found it very difficult to listen to the radio and drive at the same time. Whereas now, I don't think it's too controversial of an issue to drive and listen to the radio. It's not a big deal for most people. Or I recall in school also, I had no problem doing math homework and listening to the radio, whereas trying to do, say, English homework, I couldn't really do that. So I was wondering how it is that certain things, you know, the brain can seem to co-mingle well, whereas others not so much.
No, that's an interesting question.
I don't think there are any scientific studies about that. It's a very interesting question. I think I would come back to the fact that in our six rules, you know, taming frenzy, focus, applying the brakes to distractions, accessing working memory, shifting your focus, and then connecting the dots. I think in each of these, there's a spectrum, and you know, somebody might give themselves a score out of 10 out of 10 on two, and 3 out of 10 on a couple of others. And I think the big premise is that for multitasking, generally you're not really multitasking. You're doing one thing, and the second thing is supporting the primary task. You know, if you're listening to the radio, that is not getting away with it. It's actually enhancing the driving in some way. So I don't think it's that you're doing both at the same time. I think that some people find that a sort of background focus enhances the primary focus. And that probably has to do with the fact that you're using different networks in your brain, and somehow they're overlapping or, who knows? I mean, it's a very interesting. And this is really why it so matters that you understand your own experience of your own mind. Because no one else can really help you figure it out, and so you have to, you know, I can't listen to the radio and do homework, and other people. I was in the office of a professor at Case Western a month ago, and he had jazz on in the background, and I had terrible difficulty focusing on the conversation. But he is a creative brain, and he obviously needed it, and he was doing just fine. So I think that there's much more to be learned about how the brain works, and probably the best scientist for yourself is yourself.
Yeah,
I would just say one quick thing about that too. You know, novelty and interest drives focus, and so in some ways it might be something like, you know, when parents come in and say, "I can't believe my child watched TV all day; they can't focus on their homework." TV and videos, etc., are quite novel, quite engaging, and that makes it easier for the brain to focus on them.
Yeah. We're coming down to having a couple of minutes left. Maybe I just am interested in having you comment on the old commonplace about organization and creativity having being inversely related, you know, in the sense that the messy person is the more creative and the neat person is not. Is there, in fact, anything to that?
Yes, one of our fellow Harvard Health authors wrote a book called Your Creative Brain, and that is a rich resource if listeners would like to access another sort of whole brain approach to creativity. And Shelley Carson is the author, and what she would say is that there are two paths to creative brains. One are the linear people, you know, the scientists who experiment, you know, trial, hypothesis, trial, error, and go back and forth until they find the answer. And the creative types, you know, like the Mozart, whose symphony comes to him in the back of a carriage after dinner. And so she basically says something. One path of creativity is probably through the prefrontal cortex, more intentionally, more deliberately, more linearly. And for others, it's on the other side. And then a lot of us have a mix of both. So I think what matters is that you know what where your creativity comes from. And if you're hyper-focused and your prefrontal cortex works too hard, you may need to give it a break. I mean, a lot of people have a lot of their ideas when they take their attention away from the focus, go cook dinner, go for a walk, and then the ideas pop up later, you know, when you're jogging or in the shower. And so I think you sort of got to understand where your creative ideas come from and build that into your strategy.
And maybe one last thing, and I think that, you know, while we're on the subject of resolutions, I'm sure that lots and lots of people begin the year by saying, I want to look at my lifestyle, the way that I live, and I want to be more healthy. So that could involve all kinds of things, what you eat, and do you get exercise, and do you get enough sleep, and, you know, what's your alcohol consumption, and all kinds of things. Is there some way in which organizing your mind also actually can help you if you're wanting to work on the other kind of stuff?
Well, they go together because if you engage in the things that take care of your body, your brain will work better. I mean, that's, I think, one of the best discoveries of lifestyle medicine is that you know, we tend to think about our hearts and our lungs and our limbs, but the real payoff for many people is how much better their brains work. And when your brain works better and you get more done, you're more creative, you get to the big picture more often, you have more energy at the end of the day, so you actually aren't so depleted, and you have the time to connect with your family and to go for a walk or and sleep better. And so I see them as an upward spiral together. When you invest in your physical health, you get a better mind, and your better mind helps you manage your health better. So it's much better to be on that upward spiral and thriving than languishing.
Okay. And Dr. Hamines, any last thought you'd like to leave with folks?
Yes, I would say, you know, speaking to the idea about general health and about creativity, the book, the ideas behind them are really to help people be organized to whatever life they want to lead. People come to the office and feeling like they're not at that point. They want to lead a better life, and that is whatever they wish. And so to be more organized can lead you to having more time for creativity, more time for relaxation, and better physical health. So it's not just about sort of, you know, work productivity, so to speak. It's really very broadly about life and functioning and happiness.
Well, for folks who are interested in perhaps organizing their mind, or at least getting some suggestions on how they might do that, you should look for the book that I mentioned. The title is Organize Your Mind, Organize Your Life. Train Your Brain to Get More Done in Less Time. It is published by Harlequin. It is in paperback by our guests, Paul Hamines and Margaret Moore. Margaret Moore, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us, Dave.
And Paul Hamines, thank you.
Thanks. It's been a great pleasure.
Also, we want to say thanks to Evan Whitney, the technical director, at the other end of our connection here at Harvard.